into the future. I wanna fly like an eagle to the sea.
This is an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. Live from the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Indeed, with my guest tonight, Dr. Eugene Malov, as we talk about energy sources, different ones, cold fusion. We're going to get into some others as well, zero-point energy and environmental energy, and also find out maybe is our government already working on these things and they're just not telling us. And then again, how long does it take? Why does it take so long to be able to get this kind of energy if it's cheap and safe? And, well, we'll find out. Dr. Eugene Malov, my guest. Gene, before we get into some of the other two different kinds of energies and possibilities, why can't we do cold fusion, though, in a mass-produced way? I mean, what's holding us back from doing it? Is it money? Is the technology just not there yet?
It's a little bit of both. You know, cold fusion actually probably partakes a little of the other kinds of energy. In other words, there's a unified physics, let's face it. The basic problem that we're facing is that our primary physics model of quantum mechanics, relativity, and many other things has some fundamental flaws. That's at root what's going on. The theorists, the mainstream theorists within cold fusion, have a certain idea that when you load up a metal lattice like palladium or titanium or something like that, you can get certain types of quantum mechanical coherence phenomena that produces this reaction. And they're driving, to some extent, the mental paradigm of this. But in actuality, the experimental techniques in cold fusion are all what we would call empirical. In other words, no one really understands at all, okay, in the cold fusion mainstream per se, they do not understand at all how it is working at a fundamental level. Now, in general, I would agree that you don't need to know for sure how something is working in order to make it commercial, providing that the nature of the reaction is powerful enough so that it goes. Like, for example, you don't need to understand fire to use fire.
Right.
Right?
You're right.
You just strike the match and it works.
Yep.
Okay, fine. Okay, everyone realizes.
And you depend on it.
Right, and you don't even know you don't need to know how radio works or TV works in order to enjoy radio and TV.
That is true.
Now, if someone over the last 15 years had been able to create a very practical device that could sit on your desk, or even one that you could sell to as a demonstration kit, as it were, to physicists, doubters, and so forth, we would have won the war already. But we have not been able to do that. It's very sporadic. Now, there are some scientists, I'll quote one in particular, I'll cite one in particular, one of the best, and we've given him $10,000 recently, which, of course, is nothing, but it helps him keep alive.
What do they do with that? They live off it, or they buy equipment?
Well, Dr. Mitchell Swartz, for example, in Massachusetts, not far from where we are, is an MIT graduate. He, at the 10th International Conference, had a device working around the clock that was producing several times the input energy consistently. And he can do that consistently.
Yeah.
He's one person who can do it consistently. But let me tell you, many of the other people in cold fusion, for example, are ignoring his work. So, you know, one guy in the field, laboriously after many years, comes up with a way of doing it fairly consistently, and then he gets ignored by everybody else. But, for example, he probably, among them all, has probably the best shot. So what could be done, for example, with Dr. Swartz, is that, let us say he received some further generous donations from us, or perhaps some investor would work with him to help him, because he's, you know, like a one-man or two-man shop, basically.
Right.
get him going and get these, let's call them demonstration kits out there, which could go into high schools and colleges and so forth, so they could see a more robust version. There are high school students. We funded also Professor John Dash of Portland State University in Oregon. He had many students, high school students, interns, work on this, and they're continuing to work on it. They came to the 10th International Conference, and they have a little demonstration, not as powerful as Dr. Swartz's, but it shows excess heat for sure. And, you know, any high school student could do this. But that still leaves the question of where do we go from there? Yes, that might trigger further widespread belief in it, whereas now there's no belief, no acceptance by the dogmatic colleges and high schools that have just absorbed this garbage from the U.S. Department.
So there are no emerging public companies? I mean, you know.
Yes, there is one. One is called Blacklight Power Corporation.
Okay.
Now, they do not like at all the word coal fusion. In fact, they claim not to be doing coal fusion, and I don't believe they are doing coal fusion. They have, under the auspices of Dr. Randall Mills, a brilliant man with some MIT training in electrical engineering, but an MD from Harvard University, 1991, 2 years into the coal fusion controversy, he came out with a general idea that the explanation that the coal fusion people were giving to the phenomena was not on target. He believes that the structure of the hydrogen atom is different, and he's assembled a team of PhD scientists in Cranberry, New Jersey, at the Blacklight Power Corporation. They have excess energy in plasmas, gas, high-temperature gas, that are using hydrogen and using noble gases like helium as catalysts, and are producing some rather spectacular results. They, however, have not got their energy density up. They're more reliable than coal fusion per se, in my opinion. They do it every single time. They have industrial partners. They have laboratories around the world that have replicated their work. And quite frankly, that is an avenue for at least a commercial investment perspective. That is one that people should look into.
But
it's a privately held company.
But
so.
This is not public then.
And
venture capitalists aren't throwing money at emerging companies.
No, you know where the venture capitalists are throwing their money? Well, of course, on damned hydrogen fuel cells. Now, what are hydrogen fuel cells? Hydrogen fuel cells are advanced technology that we've used to go to the moon. You know, we've used them in spacecraft, electrical power generation. You take oxygen with you, you take hydrogen with you, and you combine them together through membranes, and you get electricity, and you get water as a byproduct. Wonderful. But somebody has to make the hydrogen. And there's no such thing on Earth as a hydrogen mine, really, not a prominent hydrogen mine. We have hydrogen in water, and you need more energy to break that mm-hmm. water into oxygen and hydrogen than you will get back when you recombine them in a fuel cell. Mm-hmm. So the people who are investing in fuel cells, indeed, it's a good technology, and they'll probably do very well.
And clean, right?
And it's clean where you burn it.
Where
you use the fuel cell. So indeed, if we had a magic wand, could convert every car to fuel cells overnight, we could, and had hydrogen supplies for them, okay, provided, of course, in conventional use by other energy sources, we indeed could clean up the air in Los Angeles and Mexico
City. Sure, but you might need fossil fuels to make it, right?
Correct. Or we would use fossil fuels. Some of the fuel cell people say, well, we just take the hydrogen off the hydrocarbon atom molecules. Well, now, here's the problem. Why are these companies totally ignoring this other process that I've been talking about, namely low-energy nuclear action?
Mm-hmm,
the reason
mm-hmm.
they're ignoring it, and to some extent they're correct, it has been problematic. In other words, it's not screaming out that, okay, we've solved all the problems. Now, either they don't believe it, and in many cases they don't, okay, or they assimilated the idea that it's nonsense and they're not working on it, or they see that there are indeed a lot of problems, and there are. So what is going to turn around in that particular area of new energy? The only thing that can turn that around is the emergence in the field of a robust device of some kind. So some venture capitalist and or a philanthropist,
mm-hmm.
and I hope for the philanthropist much more than I hope for venture capitalists. I think most venture capitalists are significantly brain dead. Listen, all you have to realize is that they've pissed off, pardon my French, huge quantities of money in the dot-com fiasco,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
All right?
They got burned there.
A minor fraction of that money, an infinitesimal fraction of that money, might well have solved the entire cold fusion research problem.
Mm-hmm.
But try to get those people to the well. Believe me, we've set up all kinds of attempts to get venture capital in. Some has flown in.
And they don't understand it, first of all.
Right. Well, first of all, $20 or $30 million was invested, and wisely so, in my opinion, into the Blacklight Power Corporation of Cranberry, New Jersey.
Okay, the one you just mentioned.
Which is linked to our website. We link to their website. And they have spectacular results that are like clockwork predictable. Now, there should be hundreds of millions of dollars put into that company, not just $10, $20, $30 million. I mean, this stuff that Dr. Mills and company is working on is fantastic.
Because what happens when they run out of funds?
Well, indeed, what happens when they run out of funds? And they are routinely attacked by the academic government complex. There are people who literally monitor them. We know who they are. Okay, Robert Park of the American Physical Society. Nitwit, if there ever was one. He wrote the book called Voodoo Science, which supposedly debunks cold fusion, complementary medicine, Blacklight Power Corporation's work. Everything that this nitwit doesn't understand is debunked.
Don't hold back at all here.
No, I won't. I'll be a little more blunt about it in the future. No, seriously, money is indeed a choking point. I don't want to be crass about it and say, look, send money. This will solve the problem. We still have issues that won't be solved, but believe me, these cold fusion researchers and the Blacklight Power Corporations of the world and the vacuum energy people that I'd like to talk about soon, the Correas in Canada, Toronto, Canada, they're basically starving for money for the kind of work that could take us rather quickly, in many cases, particularly in the vacuum energy area, from no visibility to extreme visibility.
Quickly, too. Well, now, what about my question from last hour about a clandestine government operation going on somewhere where they're doing this right now?
All right. Well, anything is possible. For example, I'm not going to get into the UFO question, which I find to be very interesting.
But I will ask you an alien question that has to do with... Let me do that now and get it out of the way.
Sure,
if there were an alien civilization,
and there certainly are,
a 100,000 years ahead of us, what kind of energy sources do you think they'd be using?
Vacuum energy. There's no question about it.
Okay.
There's absolutely no doubt, zero doubt in my mind, and I'm the author of the Starflight Handbook, a very mainstream, technical, popular book on interstellar flight. By the way. I would say all the proposals that I and Dr. Matloff collected in that book are rather obsolete. We wrote that book in 1980.
And vacuum energy is also called space energy, right?
Space energy, ether energy. There is an ether. That's the bottom line. There is an ether pervading space. It is not the ether that was dismissed properly, the electromagnetic ether that the Michelson-Morley experiment of 1887.
Or the kind that puts us to sleep.
There's a pervading mass-free energy in all of the universe. There's no such thing as a Big Bang, by the way, of a highly questionable theory.
Ooh, I may want to ask you that by the time we're off the air.
Right,
tonight.
Okay. Basically, ether energy is at the root of everything. It created, the ether, is responsible for the creation and destruction of matter. It is responsible for life itself, okay? All particles are made of ether. They are not little hard things. They are the things that we call particles today, electrons and protons and so forth, are nothing but special geometries of the mass-free ether that are in a form that makes them have an inertial quality. In other words, makes them have mass. But the largest body of energy in the universe is definitely the vacuum. The vacuum is where it is. Some people have called the energy or have interpreted it from physics perspectives, as you said, zero-point energy. I don't believe that that theory, the zero-point energy theory, is the proper ether theory. But it's nonetheless a good starting point. But the bottom line is there are devices today on this planet in laboratories, not in government laboratories, that, I mean, I don't know whether the government has these things. I doubt that they do, but okay, maybe they have them. But the individuals and research teams working on devices that do not employ hydrogen for anomalous nuclear reactions, but employ nothing but electrical discharges and collections of what Reich had called orgone energy.
Mm-hmm.
These things are absolutely real. They have been verified. There is theoretical foundation for them. I have observed these experiments. I attest to them. There's even a new form in the latest issue of our magazine, issue number 53.
Does this come out every month or bi-monthly?
Bi-monthly.
Okay.
Okay. It's titled Solar Power by Day and by Night. Now, Dr. Paulo and Alexandra Correa in the Toronto, Canada, have managed to create a special type of what Reich would have called an orgone accumulator, but they call it a hybrid orgone accumulator that sits around the clock generating power in a small Stirling engine. I've worked with them, by the way, to calibrate, to make sure that the experiments are being done properly. They go round the clock running a Stirling engine as though there were a source of 2 watts of thermal energy inside the metal Faraday cage. Now, that's vacuum energy for sure.
Someone's going to get a Nobel Prize one day for
this. Someday, yes.
Now, anyways, very quickly, as we approach the bottom here, government, maybe they're working on this, maybe not. What are they doing?
There have been some programs, for example, NASA had a public program, an advanced propulsion program, in which they entertained ideas of zero-point energy, vacuum energy. But I know there are people who say, absolutely, the government has these things. My good friend, Dr. Stephen Greer,
yes.
I'm very friendly with Steve and with his colleague, Professor Loder from the University of New Hampshire.
What happened there, by the way? When I interviewed him.
What happened with whom?
Stephen, he thought about a year ago, 2 years ago, he'd be coming out with an apparatus happened.
I've been privy to some of this information. I keep confidential what I'm not particularly supposed to talk about.
I mean, inventor. He said he had an inventor.
Yes, there is an inventor, and I understand that they are still having discussions with that particular inventor. I do not know precisely what that inventor has or has not. What the facts that have been told to me by Steve and his colleagues are quite impressive, but I haven't seen it myself, so I don't bless it whatsoever.
Right.
But I have also seen, I must tell you, some excellent work whereby Dr. Loder from the University of New Hampshire, who works with Dr. Greer, brought to our laboratory here at the New Energy Foundation in recent times, and we checked out a solid-state device. We're still doing some work on that. It was stated by the inventors that it was over unity. We have yet to see the over unity characteristic in it. Other labs are looking at it. We're going to look at it again. Until we see excess energy from it, neither Steve nor Loder nor myself nor anyone will bless it. On the other hand, there's absolutely no doubt that the devices, patented devices no less, by Dr. Paulo and Alexander Correa in Canada are over unity. Okay, this is a clear case where vacuum energy can be seen in technically published information that is irrefutable, as far as I'm concerned, and I have personally been at the lab and seen it. There's no doubt that these machines exist. Now, Steve would say that the government has much more advanced technology, which they've maybe learned from UFOs or something.
Right.
Maybe, but what good does it do us? Is it really doing us any good? No, obviously not. My general feeling about it is that the government does not have such things.
But you believe space energy is the prime energy. It's up there at the top.
Absolutely. Definitely extraterrestrial civilizations exist. I have almost zero doubt about that, essentially zero doubt. For all practical purposes, they exist. And in fact, more evidence of that comes from the ether itself, comes from the work of Wilhelm Reich in the following sense. Life probably originates very easily from the ether, okay,
mm-hmm.
with the right conditions on Earth. Reich was among them, the people who were working on that, whereas our current model of life, the origin of life, is that it happened at one incidental point billions of years ago, and then it took a long, long time to get started. I don't believe that.
All right, stay with us. Fascinating. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
Subscribe to the After Dark newsletter and reserve your free CD of Art Bell and the late Father Malachi Martin. 888-727-5505. To the best of Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie from somewhere out there. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And my guest tonight, Dr. Eugene Malov. His website, of course, linked right up with coasttocoastam.com, infinite-energy.com, just like that. And at the top of the hour, we will open up the phone lines to give you an opportunity to chat with him, too, about energy. Dr. Malov, let's talk a little bit more than about energy category number two, and that is zero-point energy, which we touched upon a bit, space energy. What is it? What's out there that does this?
Well, here we have to talk about, just name the fundamental theories on which mainstream physicists and chemists rely, okay, for the entire foundation of our scientific world, okay? And these theories are, at present, quantum mechanics, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And relativity, the special theory of relativity,
right,
that changed everyone's perspective starting around 1920 when Einstein began to become prominent. He had his theory of special relativity published in 1905, and later his general relativity theory, a theory of how so-called space-time is curved in four dimensions to give gravity and so forth. You know, there are many reasons why he became very prominent, but we need not get into them, but obviously he did become prominent. And the theory of relativity is given a lot of credence, and it basically says, as we all know, E equals mc squared. That's a simple equation that everyone can understand, that mass times the speed of light squared is the equivalent amount of energy in matter. And we rely on that, generally speaking, for explaining nuclear reactions.
And there's a lot of energy that comes out of that.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt that nuclear reactions, both fission, gave us the atomic bomb, the fission bomb, and then thermonuclear fusion energy from the hydrogen bomb, and the attempts, of course, by the hot fusion community, the $20 billion attempt since 1950, to tame it and bring it down into large tokamak-type reactors. However, it turns out that after a long consideration by critics, and there have been many critics of special relativity, very sane people, not anti-Semites who were against Einstein because he was Jewish, okay, there were those.
I understand.
But, you know, the Nazis called it Jewish science, for example. But people who were careful critics of relativity have not been listened to, okay, and have just been brushed aside because it was stated that the experiments all confirmed all aspects of relativity, special relativity, and there could be no doubt about it. A guy from Caltech said that, David Goodstein, the same man who said in recent times that you know he really had doubts about cold fusion, okay, so he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Right.
But it turns out that relativity is fundamentally flawed. It basically introduced the concept that there was no ether, okay, and it was true that there was no electromagnetic ether. This, the Michelson-Morley experiment and some other experiments, in my view, the view of others who I learned from, have proved that there was no ether whereby electromagnetic waves had to vibrate in space to produce what we see of light and so forth. But this threw out the possibility that there was another kind of ether, a mass-free plenum that did not operate on electromagnetic principles, that the Michelson-Morley experiment could never detect, okay? Wilhelm Reich, a brilliant man that he was, an unusual man, because remember, he did come out of a sexual psychiatric orientation, right? With
yes.
Sigmund Freud. So who is something, some person like that to say anything about physics?
Right.
Well,
right.
In 1941, brilliant fellow that he was, he brought some interesting observations to Einstein. He actually had 4.5 hours with Einstein. By the way, this meeting is virtually absent from all accounts of the biography of Einstein.
Why?
Because
what happened
Reich was later disparaged. He died in prison, remember?
Yeah, okay.
He turned into, just like cold fusion, an insane, pathological man.
You think Einstein took some ideas from him?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Einstein, he asked Professor Einstein, a colleague, of course, in the fight against fascism. Remember, this was early 1941, before the United States got into the war.
Right,
but, okay. Of course, both of them were opposed to the Nazis, obviously. And
and well aware of what was going on.
And well aware of the possibility. So Einstein, to his credit, felt that all possibilities should be explored in the possible quest to find ways to deal with perhaps war technology and what have you. You know, his letter later on to President Roosevelt obviously helped the Manhattan Project get going.
Mm-hmm.
But here was Reich showing him a simple experiment whereby a mercury thermometer, very accurate mercury thermometer, on the surface of what we call a Faraday cage, a steel enclosure, was higher and remained higher throughout the day than a similar mercury thermometer suspended in air. Okay, now this sounds, your listeners even who don't know about this may say, well, that sounds crazy. What could that possibly show? Well, careful experiments by Dr. Paulo and Alexandra Correa in Canada confirming this type of experiment, and in fact, giving it an even worse bias against being seen. In other words, not having the orgone accumulating layers of material around the Faraday cage. Just using bare steel boxes, so to speak, in their laboratory, they have found persisting round-the-clock elevated temperatures on the metal Faraday cage, even in a darkened room. Now, when I first saw their ether motors and their PAGD, okay, I was obviously motivated to go back and study Reich. Prior to that, I had no interest in Reich. But I wondered, well, God, I mean, could Einstein have missed in 1941 a profound discovery? And the answer is absolutely yes.
Yep.
We cover this in our issue 37. He brought it to Einstein. Einstein confirmed, I repeat, confirmed that there was a 0.3 degree or more elevation on the Faraday cage. But his assistant, Einstein's assistant, Leopold Infeld, poo-pooed it. He did some half-baked experiments to suggest that, oh, yes, it's a simple explanation as to why this elevated temperature is there. And he pushed Einstein away from thinking about it and thus broke the connection, the critical connection between Einstein and Reich, which if it had persisted, and if Einstein had behaved himself and continued the correspondence, Reich did write many letters, technical letters, to Einstein, pleading with him to reevaluate the assertions, the glib assertions of Leopold Intelt, much as today in the late 20th century and early 21st, we are pleading with scientists and political leaders to reevaluate the absurd, glib dismissal of cold fusion. Well, Einstein never did that. And so Reich went much further with this energy, the manifestation of ether energy, which initially was this elevated thermal anomaly on a very simple experiment. So just like Galileo with his experiment of dropping a cannonball and a smaller object from the Leaning Tower of Pisa,
Right. Lighting,
a very simple experiment showing simultaneous arrival at the ground, making a profound change in paradigm, a simple experiment with a thermometer, which I have done myself, by the way, to my own satisfaction in my own basement, and found the same persisting thermal anomaly. And that's not all. When you elaborate that simple experiment and other experiments that Reich did with electroscopes, gold leaf electroscopes, you find huge anomalies occurring in Faraday cages. And Dr. Paolo and Alexandra Correa have in their laboratory done many further experiments to clarify some of the many, many confusions that Reich himself had about this. They have established the irrefutable presence of an ether, a mass-free ether that can be analyzed with thermometers, electroscopes, which shows that it is possible to make little motors that work on it. Earlier, they had this patented technology that I referred to called the PAGD, which has three U.S. patents, one Israel patent, and so forth, that have pulses occurring in vacuum between aluminum plates in a glass cylinder and produce more energy out than in.
Would you say that this ether is a normal occurrence in the universe?
It is.
And it's a natural thing?
It's the foundation of the universe. There is no other foundation of the universe. The myth of relativity, and relativity is wrong, it is incorrect. Indeed, its equations describe certain experiments, accelerator experiments, very accurately. There's no doubt about that.
An outcome, I guess, right?
But the theory can be wrong. In other words, an equation can give you a very precise match between an experimental result in an accelerator, as an example, and the theory, but that does not mean that the theory is fundamentally correct. In fact, it is fundamentally absolutely wrong. There is no such thing as non-simultaneity and so forth. It's all, unfortunately, a myth. One thing is for sure. If you have a motor that is working, as I have seen in their laboratory, off an orgone accumulator, in other words, one wire coming from a Faraday cage, running a motor through special electronics, patent applied for, it's not patented yet, okay? And this motor is running from an orgone accumulator, that is from an ether accumulator of latent heat, as they would say, latent heat from the ether as one component of the ether. That's it. That ends the whole entire myth of special relativity.
Well, is there any exhaust coming off this
motor?
No, nothing.
There's nothing.
So
the only thing that the Correas insist upon as far as correspondence and of one very fundamental law that we're all aware of, the conservation of energy law, they are 100% behind the conservation of energy. Their physics is an energy-based physics. Time and space are subsets of energy. Energy is the primary reality of the universe. The energetic ether is the primary reality of the universe.
It's not an outcome of a combination.
Mass, okay, the mass energy that there is also in nuclear reactions comes ultimately from the energy of the ether.
Mm-hmm.
There is no such thing as a particle that is a point particle with a mass. So currently, modern physics says, the electron is an infinitesimal point that has a charge and that has a mass. And everyone in physics, from the most advanced universities to the lowliest high school student, learns that the electron charge is equal to the proton charge, an equal and opposite sign, okay? And that it has a certain mass, which is about 2,000 times less than that of the proton, and that it has a spin and so forth. But this infinitesimal point is a fiction, is an absolute fiction. Electrons have structure. They are structured ether constructs. And protons are too, and all the other particles are. They're really, for all practical purposes, can be no other generic kind of explanation. I'm not suggesting, by the way, that Dr. Correa and Alexandra have the ultimate perfect theory, nor would they. Okay, they're open to criticism. They have a website where people can discuss things with them. But I must tell you that they are very definitely in the right, going substantially in the right direction. They are publishing work which is exemplary, pioneering, and I hope someday they are blessed with a reward for it. Because up to this point, all they've been rewarded by is abuse.
Now,
in fact, abuse even by people in the cold fusion field, I regret to say.
That's interesting.
Right. It's like, it's even the new energy field, I regret to say, has had turf wars, and they're stupid.
Sure.
Okay?
There's politics and everything.
Right. But ether, as far as advanced space flight, will seriously have to revise the Starflight Handbook sometime.
And what does it do in terms of speed, Eugene?
There's no limitation on speed. The myth of no massful object could go faster than the speed of light is just that. It's a myth. It's observed in accelerators that you have to put more and more energy in to accelerate electrons. There's no doubt about that, okay? And you do reach a limitation if you're accelerating electrons with the kind of a way they do it in accelerators. But fundamentally, there is no limit for a spaceship made out of mass, okay,
mm-hmm.
namely us or a rocket ship, to go as fast as we would ever particularly want it to go.
Well, and in that
hundreds
case,
of times faster than the speed of light.
Then you may indeed be a time traveler.
No, because the there's another myth of relativity. The twin paradox is also a myth, okay? It is just wrong. The time dilation is not part of the universe. It just isn't. No matter how many times they will tell you about muons changing their decay patterns coming through the atmosphere and so forth, and this proves supposedly time dilation. They can say it as long as they want, but there is no such thing. Time dilation is a myth.
Why do you believe that there was not a Big Bang that kicked everything into
gear? Okay,
by the way,
a lot of reasons, completely independent of theories of ether energy, totally independent of that.
I don't necessarily believe that either, by the way.
Well, okay, but all one has to do is observe, read an excellent book that we sell by the famous astronomer Halton Arp, A-R-P, who has made observations of quasars that are associated with galaxies. And these quasars, which indeed appear to be provably associated with the galaxies, have high redshift, meaning by standard understanding that they would be very far away.
Sure.
The galaxy has lower redshift, and that means it's much closer by standard understandings. Now, he proved through all his observations, multiple observations, that these are common and that we have to take seriously the idea that the redshift is not a cosmological expansion of the universe whatsoever. It is caused by some other physics, and this other physics is being gradually revealed by people working on other theories of gravity and other theories of the ether. If the universe is not basically expanding the way modern fictional cosmology says it is, going back to Hubble, who himself did not necessarily believe the expansion of the universe, all he said was, for the so-called Hubble expansion, he said, yes, there is a correlation between redshift and brightness.
See, I have a hard time believing that a tiny little pinprick of a explosion
right.
created the kinds of
right.
mass that we have right
yeah.
now.
Well, it is conceptually very difficult for the average person to assimilate that. And in truth, the average person has more sense than the physicists who believe it. There was a cover of Discover magazine some time ago we made fun of in our recent issue, which shows the size of the universe at 10 to the minus 34 seconds, and it's about 2 centimeters in diameter. Now, listen. Since there's no such thing as space-time, which is this combined entity that came out of special relativity, there can be no such thing as a warped space-time that gives you black holes or gives you a singularity, such as Stephen Hawking talks about or others in cosmology talk about. This has gotten into complete megalomania and insanity. But let me tell you, the joke, the cosmic joke of all time is on late 20th century and early 21st century modern physics, because history will record that they went off on a tangent with relativity and special and general, and they completely fooled themselves while at the very same time making fun of such things that were giving them a hint as to the alternate physics, namely low-energy nuclear reactions, ether energy, what Reich came up with. These people ought to go back to Science 101. Science 101 is this: experiment always overrules theory.
That's true.
If you see an experiment, Feynman said it, and he was, you know, a participant, unfortunately, in another episode that was negative, and we can talk about that, the PAP engine. But if one single experiment conflicts with the theoretical prediction of a theory, that theory has a flaw.
All right, stay with us, Eugene. We're going to come right back. I want to talk with you about that PAP engine, and also, lastly, that third category called environmental energy. Briefly tell us what that is. And then, of course, phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'll be right back.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back.